Okay, good morning, everybody, and thank you for participating by video today. We have the court is split, as you can see, myself and Justice Silver are in Las Vegas, Justice Hardesty, and Justice Kadish are in Carson City. Justice Stiglitz is in Carson City in her chambers participating. You can see her on there as well. Justice Peregrine will participate, but cannot be here today. And Chief Justice Pickering has recused from participating in the case. So with that being said, I'll call the first case, which is case number 75053 et al., consolidated cases of Cotter versus Kane. We have Mr. Morris representing the appellant, Mr. Tabak representing the respondents, Mr. Johnson representing the respondents, and Mr. Ferrario representing the respondents. And I assume the respondents have divided their time. Has there been an agreement on how the time will be divided between you on the respondents? If you could let me know if there has been.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so tell me what the division is so we can monitor the clock.
It's 50-50. So it's 7.5 minutes, 7.5.
Between. Okay. Very well. Okay, let's go ahead and we'll proceed. Mr. Morris, you can proceed on behalf of the appellant. I anticipate there'll be some questions for both sides from the counsel, so we may wind up going beyond the 30 minutes to accommodate all counsel and questions from the court, so we'll just see how it goes. So, Mr. Morris, we'll start with you, and did you want to reserve any time in rebuttal?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes in rebuttal? Okay, you may do so. Okay, Mr. Morris, you may proceed.
Thank you. Your Honor, four directors moved for in six motions for partial summary judgment on aspects of Jim Cotter's, it's Cotter Jr.'s, fiduciary duty claims. The court and the directors agreed, and included Mr. Tabak's agreement in October, with this characterization of the motions for some partial summary judgment, that they were on aspects of Cotter's fiduciary duty claims. The court, however, then went ahead and granted summary judgment on all of Cotter's fiduciary claims, without notice to him, without saying it was going to do so or plan to do so, which thereby deprived him of due process under an act. And also granted summary judgment to a fifth director, Mr. Gould, on claims, all claims, and he had moved on all claims, but his motion seeking summary judgment was not before the court at that time. It was scheduled for a hearing on January the 8th, and Mr. Cotter's response to that motion for summary judgment was due on December.
He's cutting out.
Mr. Morris, we've lost the sound from you. Can we pause for a moment? Could you double check that your audio is on?
He froze up.
It might be required to dial in, Mr. Morris, on your telephone. Keep the video going, but maybe dial in from your cell phone.
Mr. Morris, yeah, just in the interest of time, could you dial in on your cell phone? And we do have the video, but the audio went out for some reason. And we just stopped the clock.
Video froze.
Okay. Okay, let's just hang on a second. Let's pause for a second. Let Mr. Morris call in on his cell phone so we can get the audio hook up here.
Hello?
Okay, Mr. Morris, yes, we can hear you on your audio now. So we stopped the clock. The clock is at 12 minutes and 59 seconds. So we heard you at the beginning, then the audio went off. So if you just want to pick up, you were discussing the fifth director and the motion for summary judgment, I think, when the audio failed.
Yes, I had pointed out that motion for the fifth director for summary judgment was not before the court on December 11th when the hearing in question was held. Nevertheless, the court held that the five directors, which included Mr. Gould, whose motion was not before the court, the court concluded that the five directors were disinterested in the particular matters addressed in their motions for partial summary judgment. At that hearing, the court did not discuss or consider whether in acting as they did, the directors were acting independent of the controlling shareholders, the Cotter sisters, as Schoen suggested they should do, and consistent with the second prong of Aronson, the Delaware Chancery Court's decision that Schoen discussed extensively in its opinion in 2006. And the court did not consider whether in so acting as they did, they breached their fiduciary duties. Nevertheless, the court granted the motions for partial summary judgment on director independence without even making a finding of fact with respect to independence. We're back again?
You're back, yes. Go ahead. You're on video and audio now.
Well, I'll see if I can... Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead and proceed.
The court granted motions for summary judgment on independence.
Mr. Morris, this is Brian from IT. You'll off the break in. If you could mute your microphone on your computer, you could keep the phone call going, and we can still see you. If you can... just mute your computer audio.
Are we there?
Okay, Mr. Morris, you can proceed. I think that was... Yes, we can. We were getting feedback between the phone and the other audio on the computer. I think it's okay now.
We can't hear him at all.
Mr. Morris, I guess now, why don't you put the audio back on your computer and hang up your phone? I think it's creating other problems. And,
Are we okay?
Yes.
Yeah, we're okay now. We're okay now.
In granting these motions, Your Honor, and in dismissing all of Cotter's fiduciary duty claims, the court disregarded Wood versus Safeway by not taking into consideration as true the well-pleaded, particularized allegations of Cotter Jr., which included the board's approval of Cotter Sr.'s succession plan, under which they had unanimously made Cotter Jr. the CEO of RDI upon Sr.'s resignation in August of 2014. The court compounded that error by not considering these serial examples of non-independence collectively as raising an issue of fact as to whether inconsistently voting to benefit the Cotter sisters, or as the Cotter sisters directed them to vote, they were acting for the benefit of the controlling shareholders, not RDI. This would place the business judgment rule out of reach to immunize the effect of their votes. Examples, appointing unqualified friends of the sisters, Judy Cotting and Rotniak, as the sisters directed them to do, approving acquisition of Class B voting stock in exchange for non-voting Class A shares that would not benefit anyone other than the Cotter sisters, as the Cotter sisters wished. Abandoning consideration of the patent business vision offer, as the sisters wished, and threatening to terminate Cotter Jr. if he failed to settle litigation against him by the sisters on terms prescribed by the sisters. This, we say, is inconsistent with case law which we cited in our briefs, Carmody versus Toll Brothers, Henry Ebbick stockholder litigation, Cal Public Employees Retirement Board, which held that allegations that individually would not show lack of disinterested or independence when taken together would so show when taken collectively. And that is a contention we made, which was disregarded by the district court altogether, who believed and said so, that independence or disinterestedness, as she phrased it, should be determined on an action by action basis rather than collectively. That's not consistent with cases which we've cited to you, including the Chrysogelos case from which says that allegations separately don't create doubt with respect to entrenchment claims with regard to director voting, but as a whole, they do. These errors made at ratification an unearned gift to the non-independent directors who slavishly served the Cotter sisters to cement their control over RDI, and who were and are on defendants on this appeal at the time of dismissal of the Cotter sisters and Guy Adams in June 2018. Thus, ratification, which is an issue here, should not be upheld under either the business judgment rule, which does not turn breaches of fiduciary duty into compliance, or under NRS 78.140, which involves contracts or transactions with interested directors, which are not at issue here, but which, at the urging of RDI, the district court found was involved here. But the fact of the matter is, and the record does not support, that in voting as they did to entrench and serve the benefit of the Cotter sisters, the directors were voting on contracts or transactions in which one or more of them was interested. 78.140 does not cleanse a board decision made in breach of the director's duties. Moreover,
Mr. Morris, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. Before you go too much further, and I see we're running low on time already, I want to talk about sort of the threshold issue under Rule 23.1 about whether your client, Mr. Cotter, fairly and adequately represents the interests of the shareholders or members. He clearly is raising some issues personal to him about him being terminated as president and CEO and the like. And so I would like you to address, I guess, what the test is unfairly and adequately representing and how your client meets it.
That issue was raised twice by RDI in unsuccessful motions with respect to demand futility. Cotter's interest and the interest of the shareholders who appointed him, which includes, I might add, the sisters, is derived from the succession plan that the corporation approved and implemented when Cotter Sr. resigned. And that was to appoint Mr. Cotter as CEO, as the shareholder, as the shareholders would wish, or at least as the holding shareholder would wish at that time. And I point out, Your Honor, that Cotter was I see I'm running out of time here. Potter's appointment was met with approval by shareholders, some of whom even expressed the opinion that making him shareholder, making him the CEO, improved the price of the company's stock. But ratification of what was done here was conceived of and promoted by RDI's counsel and Ellen Carter for the benefit of the Carter sisters and Guy Adams, who were the remaining defendants who were going to trial in several days.
Mr. Morris?
Yes.
I apologize, but can you address whether he fairly and adequately represents the interests of the other shareholders?
Well, I can't say that the other shareholders have been polled and taken a vote on that. I can say that he claims to. His representation is consistent with the succession plan and the appointment of him as CEO by the directors, which included his sisters, who together with him were the controlling shareholders. So I don't have anything more to offer you on that, Your Honor. And I see that I'm sorry that the time is now. Is this the time remaining on the 12 minutes?
No. It's the full 15.
No, I think this is the total time, Mr. Morris. What we'll do is we're going to add two additional minutes for you and two additional minutes for the respondents as well. Okay. So right now you would have 4 minutes and 33 seconds. So you can reserve any portion of that.
As I was about to say, the ratification was conceived of and directed by RDI's counsel and Ellen Carter for the benefit of the Carter sisters and Guy Adams, who were just about to go to trial. It was a litigation tactic to avoid trial, which they've admitted. Ratification could be used, they thought, to prevent that, and in point of fact, it did. So RDI and Ellen Carter touted ratification to the very late created Special Investigative Committee, which RDI's counsel also advised, and which was comprised of three of the dismissed directors who are parties to this appeal. But RDI's counsel was adverse to the sisters, which incurably tainted the ratification process from the outset. RDI's counsel then met with the SIC, after which the SIC recommended putting ratification on a special meeting agenda the week before trial was scheduled to start. The district court acknowledged this conflict, but excused it because GT, or Greenberg Traugott, was competent. But in point of fact, RDI should have remained neutral rather than become an aggressive partisan. Carter Jr. was suing on behalf of RDI. That's because the interests of the corporation in a derivative suit and its defendant directors will almost, as Messing versus FDI tells us, be adverse. Under these circumstances, courts do not excuse this debilitating conflict because the conflicted attorneys are competent. They hold the company and its counsel should be and should have remained neutral. And that is the observations that were made by the courts in Patrick versus Allister Corporation and Swenson versus Tebow, among others, both of which are cited in our briefs. And they also take the position or take their hold that a nominal defendant such as RDI does not have the right to take a litigation position and lacks standing to assert those position on appeal, which it is doing in this appeal. And that's the Kennedy case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Morris. You have about 2 minutes left, 2 minutes and 1 second. Okay, on behalf of the respondents, who would like to go first?
This is Chris Tabak, Your Honor, on behalf of the individual defendant respondents, the individual director.
Okay, Mr. Tabak, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Christopher Tabak. I'm here on behalf of the individual director defendants. Whether you look at the case as it began or whether you look at the case how it ended, I think you wind up in the same place here, which is, to your Honor's question, there is not a clear standard articulated by the Nevada Supreme Court with respect to what the factors should be for 23.1 standing. And the court, both parties here cite other districts, and in one case, a Nevada lower court, that use various factors, 8 or 9 factors, and we analyze those. Under any analysis of any of those factors, whichever set of them and whatever phrasing of them you might adopt, it's clear that Mr. Cotter Jr., the plaintiff and appellant, does not satisfy those. This was a personal lawsuit. This was a personal lawsuit by an aggrieved, terminated CEO who was also aggrieved by the fact that he was in an acrimonious personal family dispute with his sisters, two of whom were board members and executives of the company. And when it percolated out and really contaminated the operations of the company, the board did what it needed to do, and it made the changes. But make no mistake, the evidence here undisputably shows and supports a decision that Mr. Cotter Jr. was really seeking leverage in his wide-ranging lawsuits and disputes with his sisters. The record shows at least 2 probate matters plus an employment dispute that he filed, and that his remedy here is personal to him. It was reinstatement. He had very little support from any shareholder. One shareholder did, in fact, jump into the case, a company called T2, and they did an investigation. They looked at the documents that had been produced in discovery, and then they concluded and published a statement saying that their conclusion was that there was no basis for a derivative lawsuit here, that the board acted in the best interests of the stockholders. Now, that brings me to the very end of the case, which is whether you look at it as summary judgment, summary adjudication on each of the claims. The court asked Mr. Cotter Jr. through his then counsel, and this is before Mr. Morris was even in the case, that to identify the specific breaches of fiduciary duty upon which he was challenging the actions of the board. Using that exact structure, which was invited by the plaintiff, the court said and followed, in fact, the plaintiff's proposed framework for analyzing summary judgment motions. That is to say, from the plaintiff's perspective, the defendants would need to establish independence generally of the directors and independence or disinterestedness with respect to the transactions. There were 6 transactions at issue. We moved for summary adjudication of each, and we moved for summary judgment on independence. And the court ultimately granted those motions in the manner that is described in the papers. With respect to Mr. Gould, who was another director, his motion was heard at the very end. It was heard after having not less than 5 opposition briefs submitted. The court didn't even need to hold a hearing. The court could have simply issued an order, but it did hold a hearing. And then when Mr. Crum, who was the prior counsel, prior to Mr. Morris, for the appellant, for the plaintiff, complained and said he wanted to have a separate hearing, the court granted reconsideration and allowed him to be heard. That, under the well-established law of Nevada and almost every other jurisdiction I know of, cures any procedural defect, if there was one. The fact is, the court reached the right result here. And perhaps could have reached it earlier on a standing issue. But the fact is that the plaintiff in this underlying case,
Mr. Tabak,
really no business being the CEO. Yes, Your Honor.
Sorry for interrupting you. I apologize because the video is always problematic. This is Justice Hardesty in Carson City. I understand your argument and the framework around which your the district court was addressing its summary judgment determinations. But as you just indicated, it does not appear that the court resolved the question of whether Cotter had standing under 23.1. Is that right? Is there a specific order that one can point to where the court analyzes either factually or by a conclusion of law that Cotter lacks standing.
The court did not rule. We raised that argument multiple times. The court did not adopt our argument or otherwise rule on it. Thus, it was determined, at least by implication, that he had standing because he was proceeding in that manner.
Sure.
The claims weren't on that basis.
But did your clients, though, I guess, appeal or I guess try to take a writ on not addressing that argument?
Well, it was addressed in the sense our motions to dismiss on that basis were denied, but they weren't analyzed in a detailed way. However, they were denied, and we did not seek a writ from that initial determination. But we did re-raise those same arguments later when it came time for summary adjudication.
And so your argument with respect to standing here is an alternative basis on which summary judgment would be granted. Is that your contention?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I addressed it first because, Your Honor, the justice had asked a question about it, and so I thought I would start there as the beginning point for an analysis, though the answer is the same whether you look at it by virtue of a determination after all the evidence of independence of the directors, making the best judgment they can under the circumstances, understanding this court's directives that have now been, I think, reestablished by CHUR, that disfavor judicial intervention in business decisions, core business decisions of boards of private companies. I believe my time might be at an end as far as my allocation of it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Tabak. Mr. Ferrario?
May it please the court, Mark Ferrario, appearing on behalf of the corporation RDI. I think we need to take a step back and look at this through a broad lens. This case, at the very beginning, was nothing more than an employment dispute. We argued that at the outset to the trial court judge. She disagreed. She gave Mr. Cotter every opportunity to try to manufacture a derivative case. And I would submit to this court to tap into your memory and think of any derivative case that's ever been brought or that you've ever been aware of where challenges such as we have here were at issue, where a derivative plaintiff was challenging the formation of a committee, which is permitted in the bylaws, where a derivative plaintiff was challenging the appointment of a CEO or the termination of a CEO, decisions that are uniquely vested in the board of directors of a company, both under the bylaws here and under corporate law. Think long and hard. You will not come up with a case that parallels this.
Well, Mr. Ferrario, Justice Kadish in Carson City, are you saying that there are no circumstances that a termination of a CEO could warrant derivative relief for a breach of fiduciary duty?
You know, Justice Kadish, I've thought long and hard about that, and I anticipated that question. I guess if you had something on the order of a payoff or the use of corporate assets to somehow achieve that role, or if you were doing something knowing you were causing the company economic harm, perhaps you could do it there.
Well, isn't that the allegation?
No, that isn't the allegation. The allegation here is that these directors were not independent. That's the underpinning of this entire case. And it, as we come full circle, the judge determined that five of the directors were in fact independent. Once that determination was made, it gutted every claim Jim Cotter Jr. made. Now, what happened here, and this kind of touches on our fee motion and the fact that they allege, oh, this was a novel case. This wasn't a novel case. What this was a case where Jim Cotter Jr. did everything he could to disrupt the operations of RDI. He was seeking leverage at every step of the way so he could regain his position with the company. That's all this case ever was. But, you know, we had an interesting turn of events at the end of the case. The judge found that five directors were, in fact, independent. We then headed to a trial on two decisions, whether his termination was appropriate and whether the compensation committee, following the directives of the plan in accepting one class of stock for another in a stock option. Now, keep in mind, they followed the directive of the plan, whether that was something that could be challenged. So we headed to trial, and we argued that the trial should not go forward. The judge said it should, but then what happened? What happened is Jim Cotter Jr. abandoned any pretense that this case was about anything more than him getting his job back when he abandoned his damage claim because we had evidence that he wasn't paying his experts and, in fact, he wasn't ready to go to trial in January. What happened was we got the right to engage in discovery to go after his experts, and rather than engage in that process because he knew what would come out of that, he abandoned his damage claim. He abandoned any claim that would benefit this company. And I submit, before I turn to the fee motion and the cost motion, if this court countenances these types of lawsuits, then you need to rewrite your decision in the Wynn case, where you made it clear that trial courts and appellate courts in this state should not be involved in governing corporations. That's all this case was about. It was about his termination. It was about the approval of a payment of stock option purchase, which is consistent with the plan. It was about setting up a committee. It was about what time you'd have your annual meeting. It was about appointing two people that he didn't like to the board, that he lambasted, two folks that came into this mess and were entirely independent, who then, because they took on the role, found themselves a defendant in the lawsuit. So,
Mr. Ferrario, this is Justice Hardesty. Could I interrupt you for a moment?
Certainly, Justice Hardesty.
Yeah, okay. So, I think I understand the arguments you're making with regard to the merits of the action. What I haven't heard you address is Cotter's contention that RDI, as a corporation who's the subject of a derivative action, should be neutral in such lawsuits and does not have a right to participate in opposing the action in district court or, for that matter, on appeal. Could you address that argument, please? It seems like a rather important threshold issue that this court has not addressed yet.
I thank you for asking that question, and it is an important issue. And we've cited a number of cases in the briefs where that proposition that a company who has an obligation to indemnify directors, who is going to be out money, has to simply sit back and idly watch a frivolous lawsuit be prosecuted. That proposition doesn't hold water. The company has to make a judgment call at the beginning, and the company did. And that judgment call was borne out as this case unfolded. And in fact, we cited to you cases that if this was a case where there was an allegation of fraud or theft of corporate goods or something like that, where there was going to be money or some real benefit to the company, this might have been a different situation. But in this context, where this was never, should never have been, and isn't today, an appropriate derivative case, the company doesn't have to sit idly by and watch money be spent and resources be depleted, which is exactly what happened here.
I understand your argument. It seems to me the conundrum, though, is oftentimes, or especially early in the litigation, one does not know whether it's a frivolous, derivative action, and one needs to get into the action fairly deeply before you can make that determination. And I don't see where the court concluded that the claims, or at least all of them, were frivolous.
Your Honor, the case really does have a tortured history, and I think you've seen that. The case started out, we wanted to move it into the employment arena. The judge denied that at that point in time, gave them a chance to amend their complaint. There were serial amendments as decisions were made. At the beginning of the case, Cotter Jr. wanted to have an expedited hearing to try to get reinstated. That ended up being a fiasco. He then ended up abandoning that. Then we ended up in traditional discovery. And as the case wore on and as we kept stripping away, it became very apparent, okay, that RDI needed to play a role in this case. And I think it's bad.
Mr. Ferrario, yes? I'm sorry, this is Justice Silver in Las Vegas. Didn't Judge Gonzalez actually make a finding in denying your attorney's fees that Cotter did not bring this action frivolous?
Yes, that hearing was interesting. And in fact, she really didn't make any findings. She simply denied the motion. We think that if you look at the record as a whole, if you look at the factors that weigh into whether someone is an appropriate derivative plaintiff, probably the most important factor is the vexatious nature of the litigation, whether the person is conflicted, that we think she was wrong on that. Justice Silver, and in fact, the statute says either you bring or maintain an action. Cotter Jr. at every step of the way maintained this action, even after independent shareholders came into the case and saw what was going on and bowed out and gave a blessing to current management. So we think that this case, you could send a message that you don't bring frivolous cases like this that cost companies money. That's for no reason other than to vindicate a personal interest. And that's what this case ended up being at the end.
Okay, Mr. Farrar, I'm going to have to stop you there. You're beyond your time. Thank you very much. And I'd ask the Supreme Court clerk to add an additional, I think it's 34 seconds to Mr. Morris's time to even it out. And hang on a second, we make that clock adjustment here, and we'll, Mr. Morris can present his rebuttal. You may proceed, Mr. Morris, with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the questioning and answers between Mr. Tabak and Justice Kadish indicates, confirms that the court did not agree that Cotter lacked standing to bring this action on behalf of the shareholders, or for the benefit of the shareholders. It didn't so rule in two different hearings involving claims that Cotter was not the correct defendant and did not make a demand on the board as he should have. As Mr. Kabach said, no appeal, no writ was taken from that, and we are where we are now today. Mr. Ferrario said this is nothing other than an employment dispute. And I don't think that there's really any argument that Cotter is taking the position, as Justice Kadish suggested, that he was wrongfully removed as the CEO of the company in breach of the director's fiduciary duties to maintain him and not to vote for the vote to remove him in order to entrench and enhance the Cotter sisters' control of that company. Now, of course, Cotter was seeking leverage by this litigation to get his position back. That's, among other things, why he filed it. He was entitled to it. He had been appointed to it shortly after his father resigned and before his father died in 2014. by the very sisters who were now trying to exclude him from the company, take it over, and throw him out, as those threats that they made to the directors made to him to settle the this unrelated litigation involving the Cotter Trust in California on pain of not retaining his job.
Mr. Morris? Mr. Ferrario pointed out a few minutes ago that I guess on behalf of your client, that the claim for damages on behalf of the corporation was dropped. So I guess, is that true? And what relief, I'm sorry, Justice Gibbons, can I complete my question?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then what relief was being sought at that point as a derivative action?
To void the decision of the, excuse me, the directors who terminate Mr. Cotter, or to void the decision of the company to terminate Mr. Cotter. He didn't abandon his claim for damages. He simply said that he could not call and wouldn't call his expert that he had retained with respect to that subject.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Morris. Thank you all, Mr. Tabak, Mr. Farah, for the excellent arguments and briefs in this matter from all of you. We appreciate that. We enjoy these cases, complex cases like that, like this. So at this time, the court will take the matter under submission, and the court will be in recess till 11 a.m. for our next case.